With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going. You're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the Publisher Fight. It's time for the Publisher Fight.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new England power.
Hi, how's it going? And welcome to the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood. I'm the editor-in-chief at Video Week. And in this episode, I'm speaking to Tom Goodwin, who I think is one of the industry's more interesting contrarians. Tom was previously executive vice president and head of innovation at Zenith, the part of Publicis, of course. And since leaving Publicis, he's established his own consultancy, All We Have Is Now, which is sort of focused around innovation. He's also the author of Digital Darwinism, Survival of the Fittest in the Age of Disruption, a book I haven't read, but I have to say, after just looking it up now to remind myself of the title, I saw some glowing reviews on Amazon and elsewhere, so it's something I intend to read. He's also probably somebody who needs no introduction if you're a social media user. Tom has 700,000 people who follow him on LinkedIn. He also hosts The Edge, an original series on Euronews, which reaches 250 million households across Europe. And it explores the future of business and culture through technology. And Tom goes around speaking to the people creating that future. He's also a global speaker. He's delivered about 100 keynote speeches sort of across, I think, 42 countries. He also advises Fortune 500 companies and startups on business transformation and innovation. And I think one of the things that he pushes is the proponent, you know, he's very much a proponent of nowism, which is what something that I suppose a more practical form of futurism, in that he believes that we have the technology at our disposal today, but we aren't necessarily using it correctly. And that, you know, by taking some action and using a little bit of imagination, we can, you know, unleash its power in ways that we aren't necessarily doing today. Also, we've got a little bit of housekeeping from us. We've got an exciting event coming up called Garden Party. Garden Party will take place on July the 12th, on the same day as the European Video Awards ceremony. We're going to be running Garden Party in Regent's Park. We've got a lovely ivory marquee for the awards ceremony. And then we're also going to be taking over the rest of the lawn. And you've got to imagine this very beautiful lawn right in the heart of central London, in one of London's most iconic parks. And we're going to have various things going on. If you imagine the smell of barbecue in the air, you're going to have different sort of partner tents dotted around the lawns that will have different things going on inside, whether it's a bar or maybe perhaps a yoga class or cocktail making masterclass. Lots of different sort of different fun activities going on. Oh, football darts. Yes, we're going to have the Garden Party World Cup, which will be played via the medium of football darts, which, if sort of does what it says on the tin, it's a massive inflatable dartboard and you sort of lash a football at it in order to score your points. So if you're the competitive type, you might want to be involved in that. In terms of headliners, we've got Basement Jacks headlining along with Sonic, both of which I am incredibly excited about. And yeah, so you can, if you want to sort of join us at Garden Party, or if your company would like to have a tent, you can get in touch via gardenparty.videoweek.com. That's gardenparty.videoweek.com. Okay, so now I will cross over to my conversation with Tom, and I hope you enjoy. Okay, so Tom, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you on. To begin with, I think a lot of people listen to this, I think, will be fairly familiar with you, certainly from social media or possibly from your speaking gigs or books, TV shows. You're doing it all. But like, I mean, how would you describe, firstly, what you do?
I help companies understand what happens when kind of people and technology and business collide, I guess. So I'm fascinated by the meaning and the implications of technology. And that all sounds quite philosophical, So I try to use a sort of sense of imagination and sort of empathy to provide an external viewpoint onto industries and to help them change. You know, I genuinely believe that this is a very interesting time in the world and that we're surrounded by really profound and exciting technology, and that we can sort of use them to make a world that's better, and we can make money in the process. And I try to sort of approach everything from that angle.
And how good a job would you say the advertising industry has been in sort of melding technology and the impact on people?
I love that we got to this first, actually, because this sort of explains how it is that I come across the way that I do. So lots of people think I'm sort of grumpy and curmudgeonly. Maybe they think I'm sort of nostalgic, or that I don't really understand what's coming next. I have this sort of tone because I love what technology can make us do. I love what's possible at this moment in time. And I love the people of advertising. Like, I've had a career in advertising where I've met incredibly smart people in all directions. I've met incredibly hardworking people everywhere I go. And yet somehow we've put all of this stuff together. And it's really nothing like as good as it could be. You know, the quality of advertising, the degree of empathy used in understanding how people really consume it, the degree to which as an industry we sort of hide away from things like commerce and we think that selling things is sort of dirty. I find it all incredibly frustrating, and that's what sort of drives, I guess, my sort of tone of voice and the degree to which you hear from me.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would share your views. I think you'd struggle to meet people who think we're doing everything perfectly. Mm. Are you enjoying life post-agency? You were a web publicist for quite a long time. Are you sort of enjoying being able to sort of speak more freely about...
Well, I was very lucky there. I was very lucky there that they would let me speak freely. So I look back at my entire advertising career and feel very fortunate, really, to have got to have met so many people, to have sort of learned from so many brilliant people, and to have a job where essentially you're being paid to think. So I feel really privileged. It is nice to move outside of that world a little bit more. You know, I really believe in the sort of power of advertising thinking, you know, so let's get the same sort of people that we once had in a room together, you know, and rather than the brief being, you know, we've got a Super Bowl spot and it's 60 seconds long, what film should we make? It's much more like, you know, let's look at a retailer and let's rethink what a retailer should feel like in the world where the internet exists and customer behaviors have changed. I love the idea of looking at an airline and thinking, right, you know, let's use advertising thinking and imagination and ambition to, you know, improve the experience of what this airline should feel like to fly on. So I feel excited to get to use the kind of tools and techniques that I've developed in a different sort of domain.
Is there enough of that going on in the industry? I think particularly in agencies, I can really, really see the value of, as somebody self-employed, for example, I'll go on holiday, have a ton of great ideas just because I'm given that thinking space and time.
Yeah.
And yet agencies in particular, I think, are the hardest working people in the industry and are often overstretched, doing a huge amount. Clients are often pushing them for lower costs, and everyone's overstretched and busy and stressed. I can particularly see the value of roles like you, but is there enough time and value given to, you know, just giving people freedom to think?
I mean, there's different questions there, but absolutely we're not given the time to think. You know, if you look at the way that advertising has developed, it's kind of become quite commoditized, and we've kind of, I know, the way the technology has changed the industry, everything's become about measurement by spreadsheet, really. So we've kind of turned ourselves more in focus of clients, more in focus of service, more in focus of data. And those things in themselves are not that sort of terrible. But I think we've sort of reoriented ourselves away from people, away from things like delight, away from perspective, away from seeing the broader context in which our stuff exists. I mean, I think, you know, I don't think anything I ever say is particularly sort of extraordinary. It's not stuff that people aren't already thinking, but not many people express it. And one of those things is, you know, it's very hard for advertising agencies to sell business solutions because their client isn't normally in a position to be able to buy them. You know, we have this sort of an agency structure where, you know, we'll generally talk to the marketing department, you know, whereas management consultancies will talk to the CIO or the CDO or more often than not the CEO. So we never really get a chance at those types of conversations.
Yeah. One of the things that you've been posting a lot on social media has been about the, you know, the new models of working. And would it be fair to say you're kind of leaning towards pro office, pro people being in a room together? It's almost turned into a political issue, isn't it? Where you've got people very strongly on different sides.
Yeah, somehow everything becomes quite binary. You know, so I wouldn't say I'm pro office. I'm pro people doing their jobs in ways which they get most enjoyment from and are most sympathetic to their needs and the broader agency's needs. You know, there's quite a big variety, really, of voices out there. But most of the ones you hear from on social media tend to be people that are a little bit older. They've probably been more successful. They probably have kids. And they've experienced the wonder that is sort of informal mentorship of being in an office. And they've experienced the joys of spontaneous drinking, you know, on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, Friday evenings, you know, and they've sort of benefited from that. And now they've sort of cocooned themselves in a world which makes sense to them. But I'm not entirely sure that we're approaching life with the right perspective at the moment. We've sort of gone through 2 years where we're almost trying to survive. And survival comes from keeping life sort of tight and efficient and seeing the outside world as a sort of broader threat. And I think people have almost persuaded themselves that a wonderful day is one where, you know, you got to do some gardening and you were able to tuck the kids into bed and read them a story and work wasn't too bad. And for a lot of people, that's how their lives will always be oriented. But I think we sort of forget that the commute, it wasn't always terrible. No one forced you to live 2 hours away from work. You normally had quite a lot of agency, really, and when you decided to go in above a certain level of seniority, and lots of people would work from homes on Mondays and Fridays or after a long business trip. And I think, I know, I'd like the world to have a slightly more open mind to the fact that expensive coffee shops are just living and that being in an office and making small talk with people who you don't really get on with is life. And that walking into a reception desk and waiting for a meeting and feeling a little bit nervous before it sort of makes you feel a little bit alive. I think somehow we've fallen in love with this idea that life should be efficient rather than life should be interesting.
Yeah, it does feel, it feels like we're all being hyper-efficient.
Yeah.
And there is, no, and I completely agree. And, you know, it's part of me that I've come to sort of, yeah, slightly resent the half-hour walk to a coffee shop for a meeting. But then also it just breaks up your day quite nicely. It gives you a, you know.
I mean, walking is a great way to have ideas. Yeah, you know, exactly. Walk into the tube station and pop it into a Boots to see if they're actually selling your product still is sort of customer intelligence, not just inefficiency. So exactly. I don't know, I think, you know, I'm aware that obviously everyone has very different situations, but I think our attitude has somehow become skewed, in particular sort of working with younger people. I mean, younger people right now are often living quite close to work. You know, they decided to get a tiny apartment that they share with other people close to work. Those are the people who would have gained the most from sort of exposure and just being next to people and a sense of sort of camaraderie. So I think, you know, I think people are quite lost at the moment, actually. I think people have this sense that they're not quite sure what success looks like anymore. And I think our opportunity to feel really proud of being part of something has been massively diminished by this. I mean, we used to, you know, when I worked at TBWA years and years ago, you know, or Low Worldwide, you know, the global CEO would come into town and go to the pub spontaneously and buy people drinks. And someone would have just come back from a client presentation, which went really well, and they would have been happy. And you all would have been sort of sat there learning from each other, learning what's going on in the world, learning what's going on in the agency. Every single vital career conversation I ever had you know, was me saying, do you have 5 minutes, to somebody who, you know, at that moment in time looked less stressed than they normally do. And there's no ways to sort of replicate these in a virtual world in the same kind of way.
Yeah, I do. I worry about the socialization of young people, particularly. And for me, you know, coming into this industry, I when I first came into the industry, I couldn't believe that it was so much fun. And there was social stuff going on, you know. Yeah. And I sort of would go to the sort of opening of an envelope at the beginning. Yeah. You know,
there's another thing, actually. I feel quite worried about what a lot of people's jobs have become. And I never know what was me moving to America, what was me becoming more senior, what was life in 2019 versus 2009. But, you know, when I was younger, I had a great job. The people around me had a great job. And we could sort of feel the excitement that would come from pitch presentations. You know, we might not be in them, but you could sort of feel the vibrations of them. We would feel the excitement of the fact that our ads were going on TV and it felt big. And I used to sort of walk around offices in 2019 quite late and just ask people how they were doing and sort of ask them what they're up to. And everyone was doing really boring stuff. You know, the number of people that were sort of collating Excel spreadsheets from around the world and sort of copying and pasting stuff from one line to another. I'm not entirely sure what happened to our industry, really. When did we sort of let people work in the office alone late and not really be there to support them? When did we, you know, decide that we could just treat people as if they were sort of data entry people from a sort of an outsourcing website? I mean, I think we need to have a bit of a rethink about our whole industry and how we're treating people, really.
Yeah, I think just enabling people to grow a little bit. I think yeah. Every business has those tasks that need to be done, but I'll always try and give that same person something more interesting to do. Or
yeah.
So you're based in Miami now, am I right?
Yeah, sort of based. I mean, I came here during the pandemic and I love living here. I'm going to do quite a lot of sort of travel. I go to New York probably once every 6 weeks. I go to London once every 2 months, or, you know, however that will pan out, I don't quite know. It's a wonderful place to be creative, actually. I think we always think that creativity comes from being stressed and being sort of jammed next to people on the subway station and sort of thrown into art gallery openings. But it's quite easy to be creative on a beach. It's quite easy to be creative sort of walking through the Everglades. So yeah, so far so good.
And what are you seeing in terms of that sort of, there was a big tech migration from Silicon Valley where everyone was sort of shitting on San Francisco as they left, and the politicians in San Francisco, and we're all going to Miami, and the mayor there knows how to treat us. are you seeing those? Is that meaningful, or was it just a few social media voices, or is this tech migration to Miami actually happening, do you think?
That's a very good question. I don't know. I think the weird thing about a narrative is you only really need sort of three data lines to support it. So, you know, if three big VCs move here, then all of a sudden it's the future of VC. Yeah. You know, if two big tech companies open a tiny little back office here, then all of a sudden, you know, there's a sort of swamping of the city by people. I think... And we're still really in the shockwaves of the pandemic, I think. I think, you know, lots of tech companies were very proud to be the first to introduce the idea that people could work from anywhere. And they almost sort of became like an arms race to be less together and to be more free. And it would surprise me if we don't see those companies slowly change their policies. I think what's quite likely to happen is that San Francisco, you know, will lose out a bit to places like Austin and Miami and to Boston. But there's always going to be such a sort of big center of gravity to that place and so much money, apart from anything else. People always think that Silicon Valley is the home of great ideas. That's sort of nonsense. It's the home of money to pile into lots of ideas. I think Miami, disappointingly for me, it sort of crafted itself as being the sort of home of crypto and the home of sort of Web3 and the home of NFTs, which I think is a big strategic error, actually. If there's sort of one genuine criticism you can make of Miami, it's that it's a sort of city that's associated with vice. It's a city that's associated with slightly sort of dodgy people who are making money in illicit ways. And I think to embrace the form of technology that comes closest to those areas of caution is obviously quite easy for Miami, but it's completely the wrong way to go about things. I think the city needs to be much more about creativity, much more about being, you know, where South America meets the rest of the world. I think it's a shame to me.
So are you seeing anything happening, interesting happening in the Web3 and crypto space? I remember the early days of ad tech, and there was just so many shady companies, fraud going on. I used to have people coming up to New Mexico telling me off for writing about fraud quite aggressively, going like, yo, this is how you can make money from this too. And I'm like, this is nuts. But you know, it has cleaned up substantially. I mean, it's not far from perfect, but it's improved a lot. I'm not entirely sure what's going on in crypto and Web3.
Well, I think, I go into life assuming that I'm wrong, and I assume I don't know anything, and I assume I need to talk to lots of people so I learn. And I've been quite keen to get out there at various different events for NFTs, for Web3, for crypto. And I've not really had many conversations, which has made me think, you know, there's a lot going on here which I don't understand and is destined to solve big problems. I mean, it's certainly the case there's lots I don't understand. But you seem to get quite a lot of naive people. You know, the number of evenings I have someone sort of pitching the idea that, you know, they're going to use NFTs as a way to be able to own a piece of the art world. You know, and actually these mechanisms have existed for a long time. You know, I had someone pitching the idea of NFTs for sort of vacation timeshares. And this person didn't seem to know that, you know, timeshares already existed as a concept or fractional ownership of property. And they didn't seem to know anything about what it would actually entail to, you know, build holiday resorts and sell NFTs and maintain those places and what the problems that there really are in that marketplace. So I kind of feel that so far these worlds seem to have some of the best brains in the business, quote unquote, and some incredibly sort of smart people with lots of money. And there also seems to be lots of sort of, and perhaps less discerning people moving into the space, or people that are driven by greed. And it sort of created all of this noise and chaos, which I can't reasonably demonstrate that I understand. But somehow my kind of feeling about it is that this is all a kind of reaction to the current zeitgeist. And I'm not entirely sure if there's that much real logic or real understanding of business or real understanding of law or regulation or profit margins in this. You know, I think, you know, the wonderful thing about tech people is they don't really understand people. But when the world tends to orient itself around those people and then worship those people, I think we quite quickly lose sight of reality and we lose sight of how things really operate and where the friction points normally are. And quite often those things are human things. So I think in a way these movements are sort of lacking in their the degree to which they understand that they need help from people who understand people and reality.
Yeah, there seems to be, you seem to get back and forth between the traditional finance world and the crypto world of one, you know, the other side not understanding how the other functions. For me, crypto, I went down a rabbit hole of studying Tether. I went through a month of being obsessed with it. And yeah, I mean, there's just a very outright clear scam being run. Probably opening myself up for libel with that, but it seems
allegedly
it's just remarkable when you just see how out in the open it is in terms of the whole space, also with the VCs. I won't name names, but I think it's quite obvious that a lot of them are investing in these companies but then also getting a share of the coins. They pump them up by their own social media and media channels, and then they sell them off. So they've already made their exit before the company has had to.
I'm glad that someone like you has gone through the process of learning so much, and that someone that understands the world and technology and has gone into depth you know, that kind of that makes me feel better about my opinion, because I always think, you know, who am I to be the person to look at this space and think it's all kind of nonsense? You know, I sort of presume there must just be lots of stuff I don't get. And whenever you speak to people at these events, you know, they say, oh, well, you don't understand it. Just go and buy some Ethereum tonight and, you know, go to this sandbox and write this code and all will be clear. Yeah. I haven't really done that because I'm a bit lazy at times, but I also kind of think, well, I don't know, go on a walk, you know, look at people in CVS pharmacy buying drugs, look at a hospital, look at a bus stop. Like, how is this technology really going to make that much difference to reality? And I don't know, I'm yet to see any plausible sort of use cases or ways of thinking that's going to change that much of it.
Yeah. The Web3 stuff is, I mean, I think it's attractive to a lot of people. I see it a little bit like the open source communities, you know, the people who would build, you know, OpenOffice as a, you know, an alternative to Word. And it's very nice philosophically. We're breaking up the big boys where, you know, the people are going to build this new thing. But there's only so many tech nerds who will sort of be invested in making it work.
Yes.
And then ultimately, if you're competing against companies with huge amounts of capital at their disposal, and it's going to make life very difficult for you. But it's, I can see the philosophical attraction in, you know, technology for the people. But yeah, what's your feeling on censorship? This is a bit of a detour, but censorship is something that comes up in conversation in terms of, you know, if we all have everything decentralized, the world will be a beautiful place. And I'm not entirely sure.
I mean, it's an incredibly complicated thing, isn't it? I mean, we're so keen to make life simple. You know, there's some incredible irony about the fact that the digital world, you know, full of zeros and ones, has somehow made every single subject matter binary. You know, so we think that news is either sort of fake news or real news. Mm. And obviously that's not true at all. And we sort of think with the notion of censorship somehow that people are either, you know, should be sort of castigated and banned, or everyone should be able to listen to them. Mm. The reality is that these things are incredibly complicated. And I used to sort of trust systems because, you know, things like publishers were sort of ordained with great power and responsibility to sort of employ, you know, very smart, mature people to discuss the implications and the meaning of decisions that they make. I mean, obviously, we still had tabloid newspapers, but people kind of knew what they were getting when they bought those. And, you know, one of the reasons I get quite frustrated with technology companies is they don't seem to really realize that this is their responsibility. They don't seem to sort of really realize that they need different types of thinkers to help them with this. I actually don't really think that censorship is necessarily the biggest issue. For me, you know, social media was obviously predicated as a media company, and therefore it made money from advertising. And therefore the most important thing was that lots of things drew attention. And then we figured out that our core human wiring will give something attention if it makes us scared or angry or jealous or sort of sexually excited. And therefore algorithms have been written to spread things, which ultimately tend to be the sort of edges. You know, you don't tend to get that well rewarded by posting moderate opinions or posting things that are complicated. So I think the fundamental wiring of most of social media is designed to get us to see the stuff which is outrageous and to see the people who are saying crazy stuff and to see the lies. And I think in a world where those algorithms are created to, you know, offer nuance and to see the middle ground and to follow people who have different opinions, I think if we had that kind of structural engineering of the internet, I don't think censorship would necessarily be that much of a big deal, actually. I don't think kind of the monsters that we've created in this age, and I don't think the kind of behavior that we have rewarded in this age, I don't think that would perform so well. And therefore, I think slowly this sort of need to ban people would disappear. And maybe that involves a bit of engineering. Maybe that involves a bit of suppression of some voices to get there. But nothing as drastic as censorship.
Yeah. I think inventor of the retweet button, talking about unintended consequences of engineering decisions, and all of a sudden it became, you know, a way for people to band into mobs.
It's kind of crazy when you think about it that we created this thing quite so powerful. You know, like, you know, when I was 16 or 17, you might go to a party and get drunk and, you know, and I'd do something a bit weird, like throw eggs at someone's house or something. And that was being a sort of moronic teenager. And now, you know, you get to sort of go on a plane and have a gin and tonic and tweet something, and then you land and you realize that actually, you know, you've suddenly destroyed your entire career. I'm not talking about myself here, by the way.
No,
but I don't think we've come to grips with the fact that this is an incredibly powerful tool and we need to be really careful about it. You know, I know that some schools, you know, teach some curriculum to do with how to sort of behave online. But it's more that as a society, we haven't yet realized that, I don't know, like maybe the person didn't quite mean it that way. You know, we're very quick to see bad intent in everything. I think the retweet button is dangerous, but the quote retweet button is particularly lethal because you can basically sort of take any reasonable opinion and then do a quote retweet that sort of makes them guilty of something, apparently. And then people will only ever see that. You know, you can say, oh, wow, you know, I really like holidaying in Greece. And someone can sort of quote retweet saying, oh, you know, Tom has always loathed Turkey and everything that Turkey stood for. You know, this is yet more proof of his hatred towards, you know, Erdogan. And you're like, wait a minute. I was just on a beach having a nice cocktail, you know, in Mykonos, and all of a sudden it's become that.
Yeah, my approach to Twitter has been to create sort of quite complex passwords that I can only hold in my head for about five minutes, and I'll sort of sign in, but once I log out, I'm kind of like, okay, I'm trying to get back in there. And exactly what you're saying, where the most innocuous comment can turn into a row. Like you're almost be consciously thinking, oh, do you know what, I'm just going to deliberately sit on the fence here right in the middle. Nobody can get me with this, and then all of a sudden some guy's doing exactly what you said, and I'm sitting there angry trying to watch a movie on a Sunday afternoon, yeah, girlfriend's looking at me kind of going, what's wrong? And I'm like, this Twitter asshole. Yeah.
I know, everyone's so rude. I mean, the wonderful thing about I don't know, this period of time is when you go out into real life and you actually talk to people, you realize how nice normal people are. You know, like you become so used to sort of Twitter and LinkedIn and social media sort of piling on people, you know, and then you play golf with someone that's sort of quite old and you sit in a cart with them for 4 hours and they have totally different opinions on you on everything. And you sort of probe it and you think, oh, yeah, you know, if I'd have read that, I probably would feel the same way. Or if I had kids that were that age, I might well do the same stuff. And you realize how reasonable people are, actually. I mean, everyone's both completely nuts and extremely reasonable at the same time. And I think real life does a very good job of presenting more reasonableness.
Yeah. Exactly. And people just being very forgiving. I mean, I've good friends who are, you know, a difficult political persuasion and will have sort of shouting matches about Brexit or whatever else in the pub, and, you know, give each other a big hug and go home. And on social media, you don't know the person a lot of the time. It's pointed. It just feels there's just a nastier.
Well, and you have this sort of scoring mechanism. I actually think that's one of the difficult things, is most disagreements on social media turn into arguments, which then become about point scoring. And if you've got more likes than them on your comment, then that makes you feel good. And it's all generally, it's not a waste of time, but it's the wrong way to go about things. You know, you should really be getting points not for saying something caustic and direct that sort of destroys the other person, but actually get points for making a point that the other person listened to and sort of changed their stance very slightly as a result of, you know, I always like to think that arguments are good ways to learn. But when I say that to people, everyone thinks I'm a hippie or something. So.
No, it is though. No, yeah, I think it's, I used to work in a school for kids with emotional behavior difficulties when I was studying, and there was a therapist, and he was talking me through conflict, and I was sort of young and very much avoiding conflict in the workplace. When there was something with a colleague, and he was saying, well, what's the worst thing? What's going to happen if you have an argument? And I was kind of saying, well, okay, we're going to maybe shout at each other. He said, no, but like once you've gone through, I said, what's going to happen afterwards? I said, well, we're probably going to kiss and make up and resolve it. And he was going, exactly, You know, don't be too afraid of conflict.
That's how we all learn, isn't it? I mean, we learn from mistakes and we learn from finding the boundaries. And we only get to really figure out what those boundaries are by getting close to them. But again, somehow, you know, somehow if someone makes a joke that's over the line, then all of a sudden their career's, you know, ruined. You know, if someone does something that is slightly inappropriate, but only in that particular context, no one's keen to see, you know, intentions behind it. We've become very intolerant, I think, and we've almost started celebrating that. You know, it's almost you've got stronger beliefs and you're more dedicated if you're intolerant, which I think is a very strange way to think.
It is. There's almost a religious fervorosity about it, you know, in terms of it reminds me of what, you know, some extreme conservatives used to try and do back in the day. And most people would laugh at them. You know, you'd laugh at these silly protests or you must, you know, you said this, you must be barred forever from everything. And you would just sort of laugh at them. And it feels like as much of the culture has become liberalized, it's taken on these the sort of intolerance, which is I'm slightly embarrassed about because I empathize with most of the core tenets of what people are trying to defend. But that sort of extreme reactions are and very counterproductive politically in terms of how, you know, the left or Democrats or Labour or whoever are seen by, you know, sort of the sort of centre ground voters. There's been a big political cost.
Yes.
I mean, you're you know, extremely successful on LinkedIn. How do you deal with that rough and tumble of it? Does it ever bother you if you sort of get, you know, people going after you? Or sometimes, you know, I can find it absolutely exhausting.
I don't.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a great philosopher, I think Nasty Nick, on series one of Big Brother, who said, if you live by the sword, you die by the sword. And I don't think I'm some sort of Roman centurion. I'm just someone on LinkedIn. But I think you don't get to benefit by having an audience and then not get to suffer from it. You know, you don't get to learn a lot and to establish a bit of a reputation by being a little bit direct and challenging and then be sort of shocked that people have found you too direct or too challenging. So I think I quite quickly sort of learned to go with the flow, really. You know, sometimes doing stuff like this as a Zoom call or checking email or checking LinkedIn, you know, it almost feels a bit like a kind of computer game, really. You know, I don't know if you remember playing Lemonade when you were young or sort of Rocket on an old sort of computer, but you kind of type letters into a thing and then people respond. And it's quite easy to think it's not real, really. You know, it's quite easy to think that all these comments and all these faces are sort of computer generated. And then when something real happens, like, I don't know, whenever I'm at a conference these days and I do a keynote, people will kind of introduce me and they'll read out some of my latest tweets. And then I'm quite horrified, actually, because when you see it said in real life and you see people responding to it, I know you suddenly realize it's real somehow. That obviously makes me sound very, very naive. But I know there's something about the context of a screen and typing where it all feels very benign. And I've written things like, you know, oh, you know, the sort of gulf that we have between the TV industry and the streaming industry is idiotic. You know, no one should have the word digital in their title. And, you know, why are TV companies so slow to understand changing consumer behaviors? And then, you know, you'll go to an event and someone will read out those tweets and you'll see someone that's got digital in their job title, or you'll see someone that's been working for a TV company for quite a long time. And yeah, you suddenly realize that there is a sort of reality to social media interface, which I think we're not always aware of.
Yeah. The TV industry, in my experience, now they've come on leaps and bounds in the last year, the last 2 years, often to the point where they're sometimes they're surpassing the sort of digital natives in some respects, you know, and sort of doing it on TV's terms. And it's quite interesting then to see the new SVOD providers, the likes of Netflix and Amazon, Disney, you know, all returning to advertising. I mean, Disney always had a foot in advertising, of course, but it feels like the advertising model is back, which is good news for me.
Yeah, you wonder if those companies always thought that they could do without it, and that's why they said what they said for years, or whether that was almost what they had to say in order to sort of grow a subscriber base. And they always knew that at some point they'd resort to that kind of model. I'd be interested to know that, actually. You know, people are always very rude about, you know, when I think it was Steve Ballmer, when Apple introduced the iPhone, and Steve Ballmer said, oh, this is a joke, it's never going to sell. You know, and everyone thinks he's an idiot for saying that. But realistically, what was he going to sell? Was he going to say, oh, my God, this is amazing?
Yeah.
Your shares in Microsoft by Apple. Was he going to say, oh, my God, I wish we'd made that, you know, operating system, Windows Metro is awful in comparison? No, like you're kind of, you're employed to say these things in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, would you class yourself as a futurist? Is that fair to say?
I was thinking a bit about this the other day, and I know it's very pretentious, but I'm not a futurist. I mean, futurists seem to be generally so much focused on technology, and often quite outlandish technology. And I think often they're kind of employed to be entertainment, really. You know, the number of times I've seen a futurist at a conference talk about sort of nanobots or, you know, drones that allow us to fly, you know, autonomously from San Francisco to Los Angeles for less than a pint of beer. I tried to be very grounded in reality, and I tried to be very grounded in people and our behaviors and what it is to be a human. And I love technology, and I'm sort of fascinated by where those combine. And in particular, I've got this very big obsession almost at the moment that we actually have really amazing technology already. And we just haven't really figured out how to use it. You know, there are sort of magical moments. Like the other day, I was coming back into America and I had to get my face scanned to come into the country. And then immediately it knew who I was and it sort of printed out this little slip. And then I had to hand it to a person. And when those sort of magical moments happen, you kind of think, wow, you know, we really do have wonderful things at our disposal. You know, really is possible to buy something from a website and the experience be beautiful. And then it arrives and it's packaged brilliantly. And then you open it and there's a lovely packaging slip. And then if you want to return it, there's a really easy way to do that. I mean, we experience these things, which is so wonderful. But those technologies and that way of thinking and that ambition and that imagination is not really that well distributed. So I'm trying to sort of think of myself almost being like a nowist, which is to sort of focus on the unloved, profound technologies which we have now, which we can use in much more interesting ways in the near future. You know, what should TV advertising look like for a streaming platform? Like, what should the experience of navigating content be like on a streaming platform? You know, what should happen between physical retailers and online retailers? What should the future of, you know, government be in a world where we can kind of vote securely using our fingerprints? Those are the things I'm trying to sort of think about.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's remarkable that we don't really have a social, you know, social network where to have a sort of interesting, thought-provoking, civilized, maybe long-form debate. It doesn't really seem to exist. And why is
LinkedIn
there?
LinkedIn can be a little bit like that. Like, part of the reason I liked posting there was because people have their names and their sort of reputation attached. People do tend to be a lot more civil. And the way that you can kind of comment on threads and reply to people, you know, that's the one place I've really experienced conversations where we've approached areas which are quite contentious and where people have all taken something away from it.
Yeah. And on the technologies, which we've sort of been negative on a few different pieces of technology, but what's exciting for you? What do you feel sort of optimistic and positive about? We talk about the metaverse after.
I think the internet is extraordinary. You know, realistically, you can hand a sort of $80 tablet to a kid in sub-Saharan Africa and give them a kind of 3G signal. And within 2 years, they could have taught themselves anything they wanted to. So I get really optimistic about the fact that we essentially have kind of technology times human ingenuity. And I think ultimately that can only lead to a really good place. You know, things like the no code movement, things like Shopify kind of democratizing access to commercial platforms, I'm fascinated by the architecture of APIs and how you can now design very elaborate systems that talk to each other very quickly. So I kind of feel like we have all of these tools, and I feel like perhaps it's inevitable that we go through a kind of 10 to 30 year process of making mistakes and, you know, beating other people up and arguing and, you know, having social media that spreads outrage and, you know, difficult conversations about censorship. I think it's normal when any new technology arrives to go through that process. And I can't help but think, you know, the future won't be perfect and we won't solve all of these problems and we'll create new problems. But I kind of believe enough in sort of humanity and our common sense of what it is to be human that I kind of think we're going to figure everything out. It's going to take us a while.
Yeah. Well, do you think that the addictive qualities of you know, the likes of TikTok, for example, it's so easy to open it, you know, be making a coffee, to be standing there 15, 20 minutes ago, watching just complete mental chewing gum, you know. Maybe it's just the algorithm. I've been told by people at TikTok that it's my own fault for, you know, I fed the algorithm that I just like very shallow content.
Yeah.
But, you know, I uninstalled it, kind of going, I can do without this in my brain. And whilst, yes, I will watch a gang fight if you start showing me the beginning of one, it doesn't mean I want like gang fight content and want it every day. But yeah, do you feel like the sort of addictive quality? I mean, you know, maybe they do understand what it is to be human, but just in a different way, in a not necessarily trying to give you something that's beneficial to you, but it's something that taps into the whatever sort of, you know, serotonin response that is generated according to what we're watching. Maybe they're just tapping into those addictive qualities too much.
I mean, they kind of are in that if you imagine the meetings that happen in these places, they're for the people that are not necessarily aware of the broader implications of what they design. But they're not a sort of archetypal type Bond villain that's there sort of trying to make our brains mushy, even though they know that they're going to destroy us. They're just not really thinking about the broader context. And, you know, we have the power. You know, when we grew up, you know, we got told, you know, don't sit too close to the TV. We got told, turn off all the lights before you go to bed because you don't want to waste power. We got told, you know, don't get in a stranger's car. And we got told not to do drugs. And therefore, most of us have got to this point in life without having crazy addiction problems all the time. And most of us find ways to manage things that are bad for us. And I think we probably need to move towards a place where we're more cognizant of the media we consume. And again, it's no one's fault. Like, this stuff has all happened very, very quickly. You know, any parent with a kid has no idea really what's a good use of a screen and what's a bad use and what's the right amount. You know, we'd all sort of tease people at school that didn't have a TV. So no one wants to be the sort of the kid that's not allowed to use a phone. But I think we need to figure it out. You know, we need to figure out what's a sensible amount of TikTok to consume. What's a good way to train the algorithms to give us stuff that's more helpful. I think every human being listening to this will be aware that these devices are incredibly addictive. And some of us will be at different points in the journey of realizing that and trying to move on. I personally don't have any notifications on my phone. I don't have Twitter or any social media as apps on my phone. I changed my Instagram, so I followed lots of architecture sites, you know, rather than sort of vacuous Instagram types. And therefore, I've slowly sort of become the sort of master of this stuff, not being kind of, you know, treated like I'm the employee. But, you know, it takes effort. Like, it takes us to recognize that we've got a problem. And again, I think over time, we'll probably create a better education system for this. You know, maybe there'll be technology to help us a little bit. You know, I'm sure there are timers that go off if you've been on TikTok for a certain amount of time. But I think slowly we'll get there.
Yeah, I found just simply uninstalling the apps has done wonders. And then, you know, if you really have to access it, you do it through a browser. But I'm trying to identify those things that are just, yes, I can occupy time doing this, but am I getting anything back from it? And would my time be better spent actually just opening a book, which invariably it always is. you know, when I'm reading a good book, or, you know, I find myself referencing it all the time in a way that I'm not usually referencing TikTok videos or anything else. So the metaverse obviously is one of the sort of the most heavily invested in areas, certainly if you're looking at Meta or Facebook. What's your take on what you're seeing so far?
I mean, more than anything else, no one's really explained what the metaverse is. It seems to be the thing that people are working on that's most close to the product that they've made. You know, so if you're an AR glasses maker, the metaverse is all about AR glasses. If you make NFTs, then the metaverse is a way to see NFTs in a sort of more rich way. If you're in crypto, then the metaverse is a world where money and code are sort of combined together. So no one's really kind of explained what it is. I think when you take a bit of a step back away from it, you kind of realize, well, it's a world where the internet and where screens, you know, sort of overlay each other, and where we live in a sort of ambient reality where whenever we want, we can have a really rich, immersive experience where we're connected to people, which is kind of like the world now, really. I mean, if you sort of think about what that is, it's kind of gaming, it's kind of Instagram, it's kind of Google Maps. So the more that people think of the metaverse as being a place where you cut yourself off from reality and more like a sort of virtual reality experience, the more I get kind of uncomfortable. And this might be kind of privilege bias, but I think, you know, reality, a bit like I was saying before, actually, I mean, reality, including all the really shitty bits of it, is still reality. You know, waiting for a bus is still reality. You know, going to the bank because, you know, they've declined a transaction is reality. And I don't personally have this massive need to not consume reality in a balanced way, which includes the good and the bad. I personally think that meetings where you attend in person, where you can look into each other's eyes, where you can read each other's body language in high fidelity and then go to the pub afterwards, you know, I think that's kind of what meetings are all about. You know, there's obviously a degree to which things like the metaverse can sort of open different types of people up, and it can help things like diversity and people with different abilities. So there are ways that it can be a force for good. But by and large, the more I think and talk about it, the more I realize we kind of need a movement the opposite, actually. You know, I don't think anyone with kids, you know, who've seen their kids more than ever before in their homes because schools have been closed, I don't think anyone's looking at their kids thinking, you know, if only they could spend more time on the internet. I don't think many people sort of scrolling away on Instagram more than they should and sort of going to the toilet at social gatherings and checking TikTok, you know, more than they should. I don't think those people are suddenly thinking, I wish I could do this more. So it seems very much like it's pushed by technology companies in the hope that there's another big thing. You know, I think so many stock market prices are based on this idea that we're going to keep on buying devices forever and we're going to use more and more data and everything has to be extra. And I think in a way, the kind of narrative is driven by companies rather than people.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you. I think anyone who has a VR headset, I know I've sort of owned a few of them from the sort of most primitive to the sort of slightly more advanced, but you tend to use it for 10 to 15 minutes. Get quite frustrated with the experience. And it's not just because of the technology. I think it's just feeling isolated from your surroundings. When I first put it on, I think, oh, you idiot, why don't you use this every day? And then by the end, I put it down and it gathers dust for at least 6 months. And that tends to be most people's experience. So I'm not entirely sure how they've got this idea in their head that it's something that we're all going to sort of want to live in and work in all day, every day. I'm not sure. I'm open to having this unique experience where you sort of put it on, you kind of go, oh, actually this has made my reality better. And yes, my friends and family are here with me in a way that we couldn't be otherwise, saying that as somebody like yourself who's living away from my sort of native homeland, you know, there's lots of people who I'd love to be able to sit down and spend an evening with. If I could do that in a virtual environment, that could be a very nice thing. But it remains to be seen whether the technology will actually get us there. But there's no way that's ever going to replace being actually there, you know.
I don't think so. I mean, that's where it gets very philosophically interesting for me, because if we imagine that the technology got so good that you could effectively, And even right now, like, I'm in a one-bedroom apartment and the view's a little bit shit. You know, I kind of look out onto the side of a building and you can kind of see the sunrise over the water if you yank your head out. And you can kind of see the sunset if you yank your head out the other way. You know, if I had a virtual reality experience, I could basically be living in the penthouse apartment and I could just have better evenings by watching TV, you know, from that apartment. And, you know, imagine it was indistinguishable from reality. Then all of a sudden everyone could be anywhere they wanted. But I think even then, I don't know, like, you know, maybe we need things to be a bit shit so that we appreciate them. You know, maybe the whole point of life is that we make the effort to fly to people. Maybe the whole point of life is that we have the shitty one bedroom, but we can dream of having the three bedroom. You know, you see cut flowers these days and they look just like real flowers. And there is something about those flowers, which I hate. You know, I want the imperfections of real flowers. I want to see them, you know, degrade. I want them to get a bit smelly and then throw them away, because that's the whole point of cut flowers. So I think we're on the edge of quite interesting philosophical questions about what it is to be human and what it is to have a good life and, you know, what is wealth and what is what makes us happy. And I'm not entirely sure that I can see a future where that is a better one. But I should probably have a very open mind to that, because, you know, perhaps years ago, if someone had showed us videos of us behaving how we are today, you know, in the 1970s, if someone had sort of shown a clip of people at a dinner party or at the library or at school, you know, maybe they would be quite shocked by how we're using phones and the degree to which we don't phone up, you know, your mum, and the degree to which we don't read books. And, you know, maybe there's going to be a sort of reaction against all this stuff. And we're almost going to go the other way to the metaverse, which is to sort of have slightly less, but sort of richer, more human experiences. I'm not sure.
There's definitely something in that. I think that, you know, you need to have the down times to appreciate the good times. That's, I think, and, you know, there's so many sayings and cliches about, you know, it's about the journey and not the destination. But I'm a firm believer in it. You know, I sort of, you know, you see it so often with, you know, lottery winners who just get handed, you know, $90 million plate and then they're sort of divorced on cocaine and the money's gone. And these sort of things that we imagine we want, they're great drivers for us to sort of keep us going and to sort of have a reason to get up in the morning. And I think if you can switch on whatever life you want by a headset, maybe it's gonna be great. I don't know, everyone's being there every day, having a great time, going like, I remember saying on the podcast I didn't want this, but I agree, it's a very deep sort of philosophical question about, like, the, you know, what is a good life and what's a life worth living.
I kind of feel like we're a bit on the threshold of it almost. I mean, it's hard to talk about the pandemic in these ways, but it's almost like it was sort of written by a greater being to put pressure on stress points in our lives, you know, to just at the point where we were kind of slightly distrusting of politicians and experts. You know, along comes this thing which sort of forces divides. You know, just as we had interesting questions about the global economy and the degree to which China might, you know, rival the US, we then have this event that sort of starts in China. It seemed quite poetic. And I think, you know, when we looked at the way that e-commerce sort of shot up and then came back, when we look at the degree to which everything became online and now is increasingly becoming real again, it almost seems like an interesting sort of liminal point where collectively we get to think about the role of technology and think about what it augments and what it replaces and what it makes worse. And in a way, I kind of wish everyone had used the opportunity of the pandemic to be a little bit more thoughtful about the world that they could create again. Like, it really horrifies me to read stories of people that are trudging their way into the office to then join a Zoom call because other people haven't come in. Like, it kind of seems that we had this amazing chance to think, you know, right, you know, what should our company be making? What should it feel like to buy what we offer? What's the best process to make that? What's the best technology we can use to aid that process? What are the types of people that we need? What are the types of structure? What are the types of KPIs that we need? And if we use the pandemic to really think about how we should come back to the office and what that looks like, then lots of companies would be in a very good situation where people have better jobs than ever and where everything's much easier than ever before. And I think what really happened was that everyone just sort of hung on for dear life. No one really made any changes. And then now, I don't like making predictions, but I think the next year is going to be very difficult in office environments. I think it's going to be full of people that, you know, didn't come into the office at the same time. It's going to be full of people driven by fear who feel like they need to show their face more than ever before. There's going to be people that moved away that kind of create a degree of resentment for the people that are still sort of, you know, living in expensive cities. I think it's going to be a very challenging year, actually.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of thought given to I'm speaking to myself personally.
Yeah.
It was something I was thinking about constantly. And, you know, I find almost every Zoom conversation starts with, you know, how are you getting on? What are you doing? how are you finding it? How do you like working from home? And for me, I'm still ambivalent about, you know, what the right balance is. I think some element of hybrid is certainly the way to go. But there's no doubt in my mind that, you know, a few days in together and like, see, I don't know, I'm one of those people who I enjoy the commute. I enjoy people watching. I enjoy time to listen to a podcast, read a book, time to decompress before getting home. And, you know, during the pandemic, I was sort of walking out the kitchen where often I was working, going in, sitting down, and my partner would be, you know, just trying to have a normal conversation with me the way I normally would end up working. And I just couldn't engage because I'm still thinking about what I've just processing, what I've just said on that call or that email I've written. And there was no separation of church and state. And,
yes.
I don't know. And also, I just think people looking back on your deathbed at a life spent on Zoom calls from your house, and I think that was my career. I don't know. I think for some people, it's like work is just this thing that they have to get out of the way for the rest of their life. And for me, I enjoy, genuinely get the full enjoyment from both. I'm not a workaholic who just thinks only about work. But yeah, I would sort of want both to be vibrant and full.
Yeah, that's the weird thing. Like, I mean, there was never a Black Mirror episode that was made that was quite so dark as the idea of people spending their entire working lives on Zoom calls. That would have made the most dystopian thing. You know, people waking up at sort of 8 and then sort of checking emails and then going on to a call and then another call and then another call and everyone just in this little screen. I mean, it's incredibly dystopian. And somehow we've got to a place where people are very proud of the fact that they prefer working that way. And it makes me very confused. I mean, I'm very aware working in advertising in London, you know, you have one of these sort of jobs that people have characters in movies that do, you know, because in movies, people always have very sexy jobs like, you know, book illustrators or journalists or architects or advertising people. You know, they don't have accountants or people that work for the local council or something. And then you sort of think, well, maybe if you work for the local council, you know, maybe your office is awful, you know. And then I think, actually, I did loads of summer jobs. I did sort of data entry. I worked on a building site. You know, I worked for a small sort of shitty architects company full of lots of different types of people. And generally speaking, they were quite fun. You know, generally speaking, it was full of banter and no one loved every minute of every day and no one was necessarily working to live or living to work. But it was all sort of life. It was kind of normal. And I think somehow we've really lost perspective on what life is about and about the contrasts and about the boundaries. But when I say that to people, they get very angry and they kind of say, well, that's easy for you to say in Miami. You know, that's easy for you to say, you know, flying first class. And it's like, no, I'm kind of flying economy most of the time. And, you know, security lines are not that much fun. And, you know, nothing is as simple as we think.
Yeah, it's difficult. The socialization for young people, I think, is absolutely key. I mean, that thing of just picking things up that you're maybe just overhearing somebody else's conversation or, you know, the sort of cliched water cooler conversation or whatever else. It's just, I just feel for young people if they're not getting that, they're just going into this sort of slightly depressing office that sort of feels like, you know, everyone's gone home for Christmas, or that, you know, the feeling of it just feeling a bit empty and isolated.
Yeah, it's the worst of both worlds.
So final question, and I ask this to everybody who comes on the podcast. So if I was to give you $10 million to invest today, it can be a company or it can be a sector, where would you invest it and why?
Oh, well, first and foremost, I don't really tend to invest money to make as much money as I could. So it'd probably be doing something that I find really good fun. I've got a degree in architecture and I love the idea of spaces. I think the quality of our lives are much more affected by spaces than people realize. So I'd probably use it to kind of build a system of sort of offsite venues. You know, I'd probably sort of create sort of 3 or 4 offsite venue places, because it would sort of bring together my love of spaces and interesting business conversations, and a chance to do consulting, something like that.
Interesting. Yeah, I've shared offices with, there seems to be an architect in every office building. But they're, yeah, I always find them absolutely fascinating. And my brain certainly doesn't work in the same way. I'd be terrible at it. But Tom, that's been an absolute pleasure.
My pleasure.
We'll have to have you on again sometime. But yeah, cheers for taking time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Vincent.